And we're on the air, back to Blogging Heads Nation. Hello, it's Heather Hurlburt from the National Security Network.
And it's Daniel Dresner from Tufts University and foreignpolicy.com.
So this morning we pledged to explain the G20 summit or die trying.
Yes. Well, the first thing we should explain is that technically it's not a G20 summit, apparently.
You got me already.
There we go. Technically, I believe it is called the London Summit. And it's not exactly supposed to be, you know, I mean, it turns out that all the G20 members are there, but there's even more members, even more countries that are going to be there. I think they're up to 26 at this point.
Okay, so quick, let's name the G20.
Oh, God. I knew I should have checked beforehand.
All right, I had the same problem, so let's humiliate ourselves together.
Okay.
U.S., China, Russia, EU, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil is 10.
Yes.
India is 11. Who else from Europe makes the cut?
I believe Spain is in there. I could be wrong.
Spain. Japan.
Japan.
Is 13. Australia makes it in, right?
Yes.
14.
Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, 15.
There's South Africa.
South Africa, 16. Does Nigeria make it in?
I believe it does.
Nigeria.
Mexico.
That would make sense,
mm-hmm.
Since obviously not Venezuela. Well, we're up to 18, okay, so we've forgotten two, and then there are the bonus countries you referred to.
Right. I'm trying to think who the other ones could be. It could be Argentina, but I don't know about that.
Right.
Indonesia? Indonesia is also a possibility. Poland might also be a possibility.
Mm.
I'm trying to think who else.
Right. It would make sense if there were a couple more oil producers, although I'm not so sure who they would be.
Yes. I mean...
Egypt?
Egypt might
Egypt,
be...
Egypt not as an oil Egypt producer, sounds, but as a large Middle
no,
Eastern
No, but it's a large
country.
Arab country, and that actually sounds plausible.
Yep.
I like Egypt. I think Egypt is more likely than the ones I just suggested. All right, well, that wasn't too bad.
Okay, so we get huge points for verisimilitude here for both admitting our ignorance, but we also make an important substantive point, which is the ground on this has shifted so fast
mm-hmm.
that even people like us who pretend to know what we're talking about pretty successfully can't quite tell you who's going to be in the room at the end of this week.
Well, part of the reason is, I mean, just for background, the G20 was created about 10 years ago in response to the Asian financial crisis, and the G20 was almost a feint when it was created, in that the U.S. created two bodies at the same time. The first was something called the Financial Stability Forum, and that was sort of the real meeting area where they kind of figured out what they wanted to do in the aftermath of that crisis. And the second thing they created was the G20, which was, you know, a body that was supposed to represent, you know, obviously more of the world. And the finance ministers occasionally, I think they get together annually and issue a communique that no one reads. And it wasn't terribly important up until the fall.
So the other piece of this, which is interesting, is the extent to which it suddenly surged out of nowhere and more or less superseded the G8, which had been trying to improve its relevance by inviting a number of these countries to come to sort of a separate dinner on the side of the G8, which you quite aptly describe as the kids' table.
Yeah, I've got a piece coming out. I think as we speak, it's being posted on Newsweek, where, yeah, I compared this to, like, being invited, you know, to the kids' table at a fancy dinner, which, you know, there's something vaguely paternalistic about the whole thing.
Yeah. So suddenly, basically, you have the moment that the quote kids and the quote adults get to sit at the table together, and mm-hmm. it looks to me like the result is going to look pretty much as the results of these things always do. The Financial Times printed what it says is a summary mm-hmm. of the communique over the weekend, which, you know, basically Dan and I could sort of sit here and draft just off the top of our heads. And
maybe we did.
Maybe you did.
Heather, I was trying to get you into the middle of a conspiracy, and you're just not buying it. I'm very disappointed.
No, I spent way too much time raking leaves and going to marine retirement ceremonies this weekend to have drafted the communique that fails to save the global economy as we know it.
But, I'm a solo parent right now, so yes, I was also too busy to write this, but go ahead.
Well, thank God somebody out there had a little spare time on his or her hands. But,
yeah.
But, you know, there's been sort of a great amount of speculation about, you know, will the G20 be a flop? Will the G20 accomplish what it needs to? And I think that is clearly the wrong question, because it's been foreordained for at least a couple of weeks now what the G20 was going to accomplish. And what it's going to accomplish is there will be no open fistfighting between the U.S. and Europe, as long as the Czechs aren't going to be in the room. And there will be a communique which gives a nod both to the importance of fiscal stimulus, that is to say, putting more money into economies, and to regulatory reform, which is to say, preventing Western capitalism from going as crazy again as it just did.
Right.
It will make a nod to the evils of protectionism and the importance of completing the Doha trade round without...
Yes. Without actually ever completing the Doha trade round.
Doha trade round, or doing anything that even slightly impinges any government's doing whatever it thinks is politically necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a little highlighted copy here with some of my other favorite moments. Let's see. The countries will pledge to refrain from competitive devaluation, which we'll see how long that means anything.
Oh, dear God. They actually put that in the communique? Oh, mm-hmm. That's not a good sign.
Okay. Tell me why it's not a good sign.
Well, in the November meeting, they pledged specifically, we will not take any actions that will be WTO inconsistent in terms of trade. And then, as you know, the World Bank reported 17 of the 20 countries then did so in the past 6 months. So this is just sort of a jinxing thing where by saying it, I'm betting they're going to do it.
So this is similar to the news magazine cover hex, where the fact that you appear on the news magazine cover makes your popularity immediately plummet. The fact
right.
That you,
it's the Sports Illustrated or the Sports Illustrated jinx. I don't know
right.
if you're familiar with this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's see. And then come the part of this that I have to say I have failed to understand is that I naively, since financial regulation is most decidedly not my area of expertise, assume that things like regulating hedge funds would actually take a little while to negotiate, that it's not the case that some smart person is running around out there with a perfect plan to regulate hedge funds and offshore
right.
banks that they can whip out and everybody will sign on the dotted line.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that... apropos of your earlier comment, hedge funds will come under oversight of a stronger financial stability forum, which has expanded to include all G20 members and been renamed the Financial Stability Board.
Oh, it's now the Financial Stability Board. Hold on, let me write this down. Okay, Financial Stability...
This is on FT.com, and we'll link to it. And before our loyal viewers conclude that we've finally... jumped the shark into terminal sort of techno-babble.
Wonkiness, yeah.
The reason this matters is that there's been a broad debate being conducted both in public and private over the last couple months between the U.S. and the Europeans, with the U.S. saying, you know, look, we know how to lift our economy and the world economy out of depression, which is that we all need to spend more money, mm-hmm. and asking basically governments that haven't enacted a stimulus package like the one pushed through Congress to push one through,
yeah.
and governments that have enacted a small one to go back and enact a bigger one, and various 2% and 3% and 3.3% of GDP targets have been tossed around for how much, you know, it's like a wedding present. How much money is appropriate to spend? How much money is appropriate to spend to prop up your economy? And interestingly, the U.S. and China have done the biggest ones, and the Europeans are quite far behind. And
yes.
there's been a fair amount of gentle or not so gentle name calling coming out of Washington. Over
I think kvetching would be the best word to describe
kvetching.
What's been going
okay.
on.
Okay, yeah. So then the Europeans turn around and say, "Hey, wait a minute! Actually, your prescription is wrong. This business of spending more, and this is just you've got this wonderful, crazy head spinning moment where you have our European friends and American conservatives singing sort of off the same."
Right.
Page. Not exactly, but sort of in saying, you know, the spending is inflationary, it's all going to be wasted. And besides, say the Europeans, you Americans with your loose markets, lax regulation, and just generally evil consumerist, shallow behavior caused all this problem in the first place. And nobody will go back to the markets, nobody will start lending again, nobody will pick up economic activity again until you Americans lead the way in imposing tighter regulation that ensures that... this won't happen again, which I have been a little bit confused about, because even though I'm generally sympathetic to the idea that unregulated hedge funds have proven themselves to be a bad idea and that the derivative swaps and so on, ideally lots of people should have had a lot better idea of what was going on. But that it seems like a long-term fix to me that doesn't necessarily restart capital markets in 3 weeks or 3 months or 6 weeks or 6 months. And then when I sit and think about putting bankers together from 20 countries or 40 countries to negotiate how these things are going to be regulated, that seems like something that I could be drawing Social Security, if there is any Social Security left, before we get an outcome to it. So I continue to be bewildered about how that's a short-term fix, even though I get why it's a correct response to the underlying problem.
I mean, you know, the European response on this, it's much like the response on the stimulus bill, which is, you know, there's just enough substance to it so that it passes the laugh test, but just barely, which is that you still giggle a little bit at the European, you know, proposals on this. So I would say, to defend the European position a little bit, and this is contrary to my own take on this, their argument would be, look, the argument might be, part of the reason the capital markets have seized up a little bit is that there is massive uncertainty about what kind of regulation is coming down the pike. You know, I mean, to some extent, you know, there's been uncertainty in the United States about what Geithner was going to come up with in terms of his proposal. Now there's uncertainty about what the final package will look like. So you can argue that the one thing that markets really hate is political uncertainty. So there is something to the argument that eventually you would like to know what the regulatory framework is, and that way, once capital knows what the rules are, you know, you can have a little more certainty. You can then proceed to lending. That's the most generous interpretation I can give of the sort of European version. Now, in truth, as you point out, the kind of broad contours of this are you know, reasonably clear. And the fact is that right now what matters is less the financial stuff and more the fact that the real economy across the globe is shrinking dramatically. And this is a moment where you actually do want to be a Keynesian and you do want to push for demand-side stimulus. And again, the European response on this is, well, we have these automatic stabilizers, and that is really what, you know, we as Europeans will contribute to this, which, again, you know, passes the laugh test, but just barely. You know, it's not quite...
So, Daniel, can you stop and remind everybody what an automatic stabilizer
sure,
is?
Sure, sorry. The automatic stabilizer, the notion is the Europeans have a much larger welfare state than the Americans do. They have much larger social safety nets. So as a result, when there's more unemployment, when the economy sags, there are far more Europeans that will then be on the dole or, you know, receiving welfare and unemployment benefits. And those benefits are probably are much more generous than the U.S. benefits. So as a result, what that means is that when the economy is sagging, when there's more unemployment, it means that the government automatically will pay a lot more out to these affected people, which has the effect of being a demand-side stimulus. The government is, you know, the governments in Europe are increasing their spending. So it's not completely devoid of truth, but it's not clear to me that this is really going to be that much more of an increase in terms of spending, and you're talking about extraordinary times.
So, you know, the other piece of this, which I think may be both legitimate and wrong, is, you know, you draw analogies to the 1920s and 30s, and on the one hand, you know, from the American side, one draws the analogy of, oh, the Europeans are being Hooverish. I think I'm stealing that from you.
Yeah.
But the other analogy you can draw is that the Europeans saw a lot of runaway spending followed by runaway inflation followed by really terrifying political developments in the 20s and 30s, and so there's an incredible, especially in Germany, built-in opposition to anything that might prove inflationary because of the past. And so how does one say, yes, that's a legitimate concern, and we very much appreciate your having that concern, but here's a way you could steer a path between that? You know, it's kind of the let's not have the Nazis again is one of those arguments that kind of ends conversation.
Well, thanks for talking, Heather. It's been a good blogging head. No, I mean, you're right. I mean, if the searing experience, you know, policy experience for the United States was the Depression, which was much deeper here than it was in Germany, among other places, then you're right. The hyperinflation of the 20s was sort of, you know, affected the Germans and therefore the rest of Europe. So there's no question that's concerned. I think what you point to is what you're actually seeing in terms of the data, which is, you know, I'm much more afraid of price deflation at this point than I am of inflation. And part of the problem here is the Europeans do have a point, but it's sort of a point that you want to make about 2 years from now, or, you know, a year from now rather than now, which is to say that the economy has so much slack in it right now that inflation is not really that big of a concern. The concern is deflation because demand is so slack. But they're right that, you know, about a year from now, if the economy is growing again, you are going to have to start seeing, you know, the U.S. Central Bank and the European Central Bank start scaling back on their quantitative easing, and you want to see more fiscal discipline on the U.S. side. On the other hand, you know, if you take a look at Tim Geithner's past, he's pretty much on board with all this. So I'm not terribly concerned that the U.S. is suddenly going to be, you know, inflation happy as a result of this. How do you convince the Germans about this? I think the only way you're going to convince the Germans about this, unfortunately, is if the Germans suffer more economic stagnation. It's really going to be the only thing that's going to motivate them on this point.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, there's an interesting sort of parallel on both sides here where sort of each government, and, you know, you can critique some aspects of the Geithner bank rescue plan this way, yeah, is sort of deciding to do the minimum politically saleable. And mm-hmm. just there's kind of an expectation the Europeans will be forced to ratchet up the stimulus as it gets yeah. worse. We may or may not be forced to ratchet up the bank rescue plan as it right. gets worse. And what's politically unthinkable today may, God forbid, be politically necessary in a few months. And you sort of, one looks at this, or I do, from the sort of amateur political science background and just say, you know, gosh, isn't there any other way? And the answer seems to be no, which yeah. I think is the final word on the G20. And so my question is then, what comes after?
That's a very scary question. I mean, the people I've talked to are very nervous about what happens once the summer rolls around and if there's, you know, continued economic stagnation. That on the whole, the general perception is, for example, that we've avoided really serious levels of protectionism. Mostly there's been kind of ticky-tack stuff. Yeah. But that's because, you know, we're still in the early phase. If there continues to be, contraction of the economies and greater job loss, it's going to be tougher for, you know, legislatures to resist these kinds of political pressures. And that, I think, is one of the things that no one's really talked about. You've actually seen some degree of coordination among central banks, for example, since the crisis started. But I think part of the reason for that is that central banks across the board are much more politically insulated. On the other hand, trying to ask for things like fiscal expansion or trade liberalization requires that legislatures have to step up, and they're not really in the mood to do that at this point. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think the G20, you know, outcome is going to be one that's largely, let me put it this way. I'm much more interested in what happens on the margin meeting between Obama and Chinese President Hu Jintao than I am in terms of what actually happens at the G20, because I think it's mostly, as you read, going to be boilerplate. They're going to agree to disagree on fiscal stimulus. They're going to, you know, agree but kind of, you know, softly disagree on the scope of financial regulation. And they're going to agree to disagree also on the IMF. That's the third leg on this, which is to expand the IMF's borrowing. But China's made clear that they're not going to pony up the money unless they get greater voting share, which, by the way, is not an unreasonable position as far as the Chinese are concerned.
So let's move to the Chinese in a second, but I want to poke you on one thing about protectionism.
Yeah.
I think the word gets tossed around to indicate two different kinds of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one is the kind of, as you said, sort of ticky-tack stuff that the U.S. and some of the Western Europeans have done. The Buy American Act on the stimulus is really going to impact a very, very – ooh, I just used impact as a verb. My bad. Is really going to affect a very small –
Do you have that tick too? I always get nervous if I use impact as a verb.
It's not a verb. It's not a verb, and I'm slowly being corrupted by people around me.
No, but this is fascinating. I have the same thing. I remember being traumatized in a college paper where I used the term impact as a verb. You know, my professor said, don't ever do that.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I've always avoided doing that since then. But it's funny to know that I'm not the only one with that tick.
No, it's yet another sort of generational slackening of the
yes.
of the language and the letting down of standards and whatever. The sort of the voice of my mother, the English major, versus the voices of the 20-somethings that I work with, who
the
all
voice of the Brookings Institution,
think it's
yeah.
a verb, are battling in my head at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But on protectionism, you have the kind of ticky-tack stuff, which is tempting to Western countries because it, you know, it produces, frankly, a political benefit that's well in excess of the actual substantive benefit it produces for anybody.
Yeah.
And then there's the question of sort of much more serious, large-scale closings, which, frankly, would have much less effect here than they would in the developing world and would hurt the poorest countries that we aren't even really talking about so far in this conversation. And I sometimes think part of the problem with having a serious conversation about, you know, cutting the hypocrisy levels on protectionism is that we insist in lumping the two things together, as if everything is equally bad, instead of recognizing that there's a continuum of stuff, and sometimes it's probably better to do the little things to avoid doing the big things, if that works politically?
Well, no, I mean, that's an interesting analogy. In some ways, you can argue that there are forms of protectionism that are almost like pork barrel or earmarks, which is, yeah, you know, I mean, you can make the political argument that if you accept the Buy American provisions, for example, it avoids, you know, much stupider policies,
which
would really have a calamitous effect. My concern on this is that, everyone keeps saying, I mean, the WTO issued something recently saying, well, you know, we have an increase in protectionism, but, you know, we're probably not going to ever go back to the 30s. And I tend to agree with that, but let me sketch out a scenario whereby I actually think you could wind up back in the 30s, which is, you know, first of all, you're going to have, you know, legislatures in developed countries getting ever more inventive about ways to block, you know, trade, either through the forms of linking it to government procurement, or let's say the U.S. accusing China of being a currency manipulator and therefore, you know, attacking it on currency grounds. Or, you know, 2 weeks ago, Stephen Chu said that he was open to the idea. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu said he was open to the idea of using carbon tariffs as a way of trying to punish countries not, you know, taking steps on global warming. On the developing country side, one of the things that people don't realize, and one of the reasons why the Doha Round actually mattered, is that one of the things that was being negotiated was the notion that developing countries would lower what were called bound tariffs as opposed to applied tariffs. Bound tariffs are what countries were legally could not raise tariff levels above. Applied tariffs are what these countries' tariff levels actually are. Now, across the developing world, applied tariffs are dramatically lower than bound tariffs. So in other words, if countries wanted to, if countries like China or India or Mexico wanted to increase their tariffs, they could do so and it would be WTO consistent because the bound on this is much higher than what they've actually applied. And I could see a sort of, you know, tit-for-tat scenario whereby if the developing countries think that the developed world is going to shut them out eventually, then they'll respond in kind. And then you can also have, you know, as we talked about, currency wars where you're seeing competitive devaluations. And to some extent, you're kind of seeing that already with forms of quantitative easing. Then add to that sort of regulatory, you know, blocks and things like that. And I can see us slowly moving to that point. Maybe where it won't be as bad as the 30s, but, you know, it could be as bad as the 20s, the 20s, which was not terribly, you know, liberal in that sense.
Right. So from a policy point of view, another thing I find really striking about this debate is that the way we try to address this problem is, you know, sort of more and more international meetings, which produce more and more hypocritical statements as everybody looks around the room and sort of could understand perfectly well the reasons that others will go back and sign things from their legislatures or, for those whose legislatures are less relevant, go home and impose them themselves. Where actually, you know, if you're going to fix this in the long run, it seems to me that that's actually exactly, ratcheting up the hypocrisy level is exactly the wrong approach.
Yeah.
And that, in fact, what you need to be doing is building new, and I mean, that this is certainly true in the, I mean, the U.S. would have to take the lead on this, but we're not the only ones with this problem. Building a new compact with the folks that are most affected and their political representatives in terms of what their expectations from trade are. And I think, I mean, the Obama administration has a marvelous opportunity to do this because of who it counts in its sort of core coalition of supporters. But, you know, this is the worst time in the world for them to try to do it on top of everything else they've got on their plate. But, you know, global recession or no, the trade consensus had already frayed pretty badly. And so these really, you know, sort of more hypocritical international statements are exactly the wrong way to go. And the question I always ask my kind of trade fundamentalist foreign policy and national security friends is, you know, and when's the last time you and your organization were out there lobbying for better trade adjustment assistance? Which is, you know, in the long run, the thing that would make protectionism less of a problem here. If you could convince farmers and factory workers, and to the extent there are any left textile workers, that any of those promises actually meant anything?
Well, a few things on this. The first is, I don't think trade adjustment assistance is going to satisfy labor this time around.
No, I agree with you on that.
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, I've talked to, you know, in the past I've talked to some of the AFL-CIO people, and they're pretty blunt in saying, you know, yeah, we want trade adjustment assistance, but we really and secretly don't want it because it makes it easier for us to, to maintain our position. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that, you know, one of the Obama positions on trade has always been, well, we've got to talk about labor and environmental standards in our trade agreements now going forward. And, you know, from the U.S. perspective, one could argue that there's a logic for that. The problem is that from the perspective of other countries, that's code. And the code is that they want to create, you know, ways in which they can block, you know, our other countries' exports into the United States. So in other words, from their perspective, when the U.S. starts talking about labor rights, they think that what they're talking about is, well, our wages are lower, therefore there must mean that there's labor abuses. And so
they're not always wrong.
They're not always wrong.
Both things are true. Both there are labor abuses and there's just lower wages.
Yes, although mostly it's lower wages. I mean, and we might disagree about this, but
I think we disagree pretty strongly on actually.
I think we disagree on this in the sense of, I don't deny there are labor abuses going on. I mean, that it would be folly to claim otherwise. On the other hand, I'm kind of on the sort of two cheers for sweatshop school, where, you know, trying to get these countries to impose labor standards before they're rich enough to actually enforce the labor standards does strike me as bordering on the absurd. And the best way you're going to have these countries, you know, practice better labor standards is if they're richer.
So that means that Korea and Thailand shouldn't be enforcing labor standards because they're not rich enough yet.
No, Korea and Thailand, Korea probably. I'm not sure about Thailand. But on the other hand, I don't think, how to put this, I don't think labor unions are terribly weak in South Korea, last I checked. So, you know, this is one of those where, again, it actually comes off, and this is the thing I've been hammering on for years now, where the Democrats have always, you know, always attacked the Bush administration as being imperious and imperial in terms of dictating how other countries should run their own systems by pushing things like, you know, insisting that democracy was the best way. It's not clear to me that this is any different in terms of the trade front by saying you will, you know, have your labor standards, you know, erected the way we want to see them erected. You know, I think labor unions in South Korea have no problem knowing what their own interests are on this point.
Yep, that is actually very, very true. Although it's kind of a strange, it's a very different system. But, you know, I guess the fundamental point I would make about this is there would actually be nothing wrong, and the Stephen Chu thing is a great example, there would actually be nothing wrong with the U.S. as a society deciding that we prized controlling global warming more than we prized free trade orthodoxy. That's a perfectly legitimate decision for a society to make. Similarly, there would be nothing wrong, although I'm not holding my breath for it to happen, with the U.S. deciding that we prized exporting a certain vision of labor rights more, although you raise a legitimate question about what the best way to export that vision is. But we've gotten ourselves stuck into this place where we think that free trade is an end in itself, and it's actually not. It's a means to an end, and there's a number of ends and a number of means. And I'm not sort of turning into a giant protectionist in front of your eyes or anything, but I do think we've kind of developed an unchallengeable orthodoxy, which is right now actually sort of reality is challenging, and the question is, do we catch up to it and figure out what works, or do we just keep piling on these hypocritical statements that actually hurt us more, I think, both with our own public and globally?
All right, so Heather, first of all, as a, you know, committed free trader, I have to do the following obligatory thing. Protectionist! Protectionist! Burn her! Burn her! Burn her at the stake! Okay, done with that. I think you're correct in pointing out that free trade should not be an end in itself, and rather we should, you know, talk seriously about whether or not, you know, trade liberalization leads to other benefits that we want to see. And I think you could argue that they do, but this again raises the rather awkward question of just how much we want to replicate the 1930s, which is to say that one of the other arguments, you know, I mean, there are the economic arguments in favor of free trade, and, you know, we don't need to rehash that. But there's also the political argument, which is that, you know, greater interdependence actually does impose fundamental constraints on what governments will do in terms of, you know, ratcheting up political conflict. And I think you're seeing this to some extent, you know, in terms of the war of words between China and the United States, and it's not a war of anything else, hopefully. And, you know, one of the sort of last legs to fall before you had World War II was the fact that you had countries that were fundamentally not dependent on each other, so the costs of military conflict were much lower back then.
So, except that the 20s were actually the most economically interdependent period ever before the present one.
Well, no, prior to World War One was, I would argue.
I'm sorry, prior to World War... But
it was interdependent, I'll take your point.
Yeah, and it's not... So it's always reversible when nations decide that this is, you know, that sort of... The free trade instrument is a very useful instrument, but it's not a magical, irreversible instrument, just like democratization is not
a magic, irreversible
instrument. And I also, I just have to tease a little bit and say that, you know, if we're making fun of the Germans for insisting that they can't be trusted not to repeat their 1930s experience, and now we're suddenly saying that we can't be trusted not to repeat our 1930s experience, you know, the application of 30s analogies clearly has to be carefully policed by... So that's what we'll create a 30s analogy police. How
about the analogy
that?
Cops? Yes, I like that. The historical analogy cops. That's good.
But let's talk about China, because you were saying you've done actually some more scholarly writing on China, and there was this whole brouhaha last week over the senior official from the Chinese central bank.
Yeah.
Posting an article on a website, which I thought was a marvelously 21st century moment, when the Chinese inform the world that they think maybe the reserve currency situation should change, how? By posting an article on an internal Chinese website. And then there was much sort of heat and very little light in the U.S. political environment about what this meant. Was China walking away from the U.S. currency?
Right.
Should we accept that? Could we? And then Brad... Setzer over at the Council on Foreign Relations over the weekend made the point that actually this may have as much to do with the internal situation in China and the Chinese government being looked at by its own population and saying, hey, you guys invested all this money in the U.S. and that's not turning out so well. What'd you do with our money? Which was kind of an interesting angle on the whole thing that I will freely admit I had not thought of before, and that you could actually view the piece as a kind of defensive, see, we can figure out a way to respond to the fact that we've been burned so badly by what's happened in the American economy, which I thought was a fascinating angle. And it seems to me that probably some of both is true, that yes, when you stop and think about it, the Chinese government has got some splaining to do internally. But also, of course, the Chinese would be in a better position if the global reserve currency weren't the dollar. Isn't that right? Or is it not right?
Well, it's complicated. Now, to tell you the truth, it's not clear. I mean, part of the problem is that China has incredibly mixed motives on this. Let me first step back and say, you know, for a second, this is one of those issues that sort of exposes, as you pointed out in an email, that, you know, going into the G20 summit, there's been a lot of sort of bash America. America's at the center of, you know, the financial crisis. Therefore, we should, you know, America should be responsible for getting out of it. That kind of lets a lot of other countries off the hook a little bit. I mean, this is not to deny that America probably deserves the majority of the blame in terms of lax financial regulation. But part of the reason that there was so much capital sloshing around in the United States was, among others, China. China was buying massive amounts of dollars in order to keep their currency, the renminbi, undervalued in order to fuel what was considered an export-led development path. The result was that it now holds about $2 trillion, a little less than $2 trillion worth of currency reserves. And it's stuck. And so one of the fascinating things about this is that, you know, on the American side, you're right. There's a lot of people that are very, you know, terribly worried about the fact that China holds so many dollars, and that's like a sort of Damocles, you know, over the U.S. economy, that at any moment they could pursue what's called the nuclear option and just dump all the dollars and crash our currency. The fascinating thing is that from the Chinese perspective, you've got some people in China sort of feeling their oats and saying we should use this as a weapon. But a lot of other Chinese, as you said, are pissed off at the leadership because they're convinced that we tricked them into doing this. That we got China to buy large amounts of dollars, you know, and with the knowledge that we were eventually going to inflate our currency, which would then cause the dollar to depreciate, which will then cause massive losses in terms of China's balance sheet. In fact, there's a book that's very popular in China now called Currency Wars that makes this exact argument. And so part of what's been going on in the last month, you know, a couple weeks ago, Wen Jiabao, the prime minister, said he was worried about the security of China's dollar assets. And then this latest paper, part of it, I agree with you, is sort of, you know, playing to domestic audiences that are furious, really furious, that China made disastrous investments in places like Morgan Stanley or Blackstone in the United States. So that's partly what's going on. At the same time, China also doesn't really have a solution at this point to how to get out of this mess. You know, they still hold very, very large amounts of dollars, you know, even though the value of the portfolio has gone down. And furthermore, it's not clear they see a real path to economic growth beyond exports. For all the talk about China's stimulus package, and it is pretty serious, the stimulus package is mostly geared towards investment, not towards promoting consumption by Chinese consumers, which is really the primary way you're going to end these kind of macroeconomic imbalances that have been driving, you know, all this concern to date. So as much as China is upset at the United States, it's also not clear China has a different idea for how to arrange things. The paper that you talk about that the central bank governor put forward is kind of interesting in a long-term perspective kind of way in terms of proposing a global currency, except I don't think it's politically feasible, and I don't think it's economically feasible either. And most of the serious people who have looked at it have sort of said, you know, people like Barry Eichengreen have said, this isn't going to happen just because the Chinese central bank wants it to happen. And the same day they issued this report, it should be pointed out, the head of the State Administration of Foreign Exchange there said, we're going to continue to buy dollars. So as much as this is, you know, China desperately trying to find a way to rejigger the current system, I don't know if they actually have a clear plan for doing that.
Yeah, I mean, the two sort of things that came immediately to my mind is, given how little the G20 finds itself able to agree on, the idea that you could negotiate a new reserve currency seems pretty fantastical to me. It reminds me of the old joke about how you reform the Soviet economy. And the realistic solution is that little green men from Mars come down and do it, and the unrealistic solution is that the Soviets do it themselves.
That's good.
There's a Polish version of that in which the realistic version is performed by the Virgin Mary, which I always liked. But so first of all, what is the level of catastrophe that would have to happen for countries to agree on this, even setting aside that it's very hard to imagine any scenario under which the U.S. happily goes to negotiation and says, yeah, you know what, we're tired of being the reserve currency, let's let somebody else do it now. And then the other point you make about China lacking an alternate growth model, you look at, I mean, it's hard to compare China to anyone else because they're so enormous, but you look at the export-led growth models around them, and, you know, you have... in a way, it's sort of too early to say about South Korea, Thailand, the other so-called Southeast Asian tigers. And right. Then, you know, you look at the Japanese experience, which 30 years ago they were going to take over the world, and nowadays that's not a very, you know, it's a very nice lifestyle for everybody, but not a very happy story from the economist's point of view. So What do the Chinese look at in terms of thinking about how to develop their model?
I mean, they can look at the United States and they can look at Europe. Those are really their two options at this point. And part of the problem is that, you know, it's much easier for a country like Thailand to have export-led growth, you know, at a relatively high rate than it is for a country like China, where you're talking about 1 billion people. They have to export a hell of a lot more for it to have that kind of, you know, kick within that country. And you know, to be fair, it's not easy to do this sort of thing. I mean, you know... One of the fascinating things, I think, about the global economy has been the extent to which sort of, you know, countries that are traditionally export-led have not been able, you know, to boost their domestic consumption. And then on the U.S. side, you know, our country, which has largely been a consumption-driven economy, you know, is now facing the fact that it actually needs to save a little more. And it's not terribly used to that either. So these are sort of embedded, you know, historical practices that I'm not sure are going to be able to be, you know, changed anytime soon.
So we should pause a moment on a couple of our other unwilling bankers, and I've been dismissing the Russian position on the idea of changing reserve currency as sort of one where the Russians can posture and go along with the Chinese at absolutely no cost to themselves, but that they have really relatively little influence on this. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said this in a blog post recently. Whenever I hear the Russians speak, all I keep thinking in my head is demography, demography, demography. The Russians don't have, I mean, you know, the Russians kind of like to do this sort of thing. But, I mean, even, I think, Alexei Kudrin, the foreign minister, admitted that, you know, their proposal to get rid of the dollar as the reserve currency was not going to take place for another 30 years.
It's political. It's useful political posturing for them, but they don't bring a lot of weight to the table. And then, yeah. But then the other question is the Arab world, which has also sort of, in it to an extent that I think hasn't necessarily been fully realized, served as the Chinese did to obligingly buy up and hold our dollars for
right.
us. And that, you know, that raises a whole other sort of interesting set of problems, which leads us into the question of the lasting geopolitical implications that all this has.
Well, this is one of the, I mean, you know, there's sort of a lot of different props for the dollar as the world's currency, and two of the biggest ones are Japan and the Arab states. And, you know, part of the reason they do that is that there's sort of an implicit quid pro quo of security guarantees. You know, those countries are pretty strong allies of the United States, and therefore...
Yeah, this is where I feel like I should start yelling, Marxist, Marxist, at you. Are you saying those countries are buying our security guarantees and that we're nothing but mercenaries? Daniel, is that what you're saying?
No, there are very strong and deep-seated ties between us and the Emirate of Kuwait. No, I mean, I don't think buying is a little harsh. I would say it is a policy quid pro quo. And, you know, do bear in mind that also the U.S. gets some other benefits out of this, among other things, relatively, you know, secure oil supplies, one would hope. But, yeah, I mean, I think that is going on in both the Japanese case and in the Middle East. And part of the irony, of course, is that the larger China and the more threatening China gets, my hunch is that the more these other countries were going to want to look to see, you know, to the United States as a balancer. And not just within, not just in the Middle East or in Japan, but also across the rest of the Pacific Rim. I guarantee you South Korea is not, you know, going to be happy by a China that's feeling its oats and wanting to develop a blue water navy. And same with the rest of the Pacific Rim. So one of the odd equilibrating mechanisms I think that's going on is that the more that China tries to aggressively pursue its own national interests, and I should add that, you know, as they grow more powerful, one would expect that. And I also would add, I think they have a point on the IMF, that I think they actually should have much more voting power mm-hmm. on the IMF. But it's going to lead these other countries, I suspect, to balance more with the United States than with China.
Is there any realistic possibility of achieving IMF reform that gives them more voting power and, frankly, leverages them more so that the IMF is able to issue more support to countries that need it? Is that... Since I've spent this whole time poo-pooing how long it takes to negotiate anything, that to me seems like an absolute priority, yet it's very unclear on how, when and whether it might be accomplished.
Well, once again, Europe is to blame. because the answer is that, yeah, obviously I think China, India, a lot of these countries should be getting more power. The question then becomes, well, if they're getting more power, who should be getting less? And the answer, surprisingly, is not the United States. The United States actually has less voting power in the IMF than either its contribution to the fund or its sort of share of global GDP. So the U.S. is actually underrepresented in the fund. There are two groups that are overrepresented in the fund. The first is Europe, which has way too many seats. And the second is Sub-Saharan Africa. And so that raises a much thornier question. But, you know, last I've checked, countries that actually hold power, you know, legally have been remarkably reluctant to give that up voluntarily. Which is why Britain and France are still on the Security Council. So, yeah, I agree with you that part of the issue is that are these regimes going to have to be so broken that you eventually have a reordering, you know, moment where everyone agrees, okay, look, let's just, you know, wipe the slate clean and start over, or are we going to have this, you know, continued persistence on this point? I unfortunately think you're going to have continued persistence of sort of stasis and stagnation on this point.
Yeah, because if this isn't the wipe the slate clean moment, I just don't know what is.
Well, this is...
Or, I mean, I guess the question is, I guess I could find out in 6 or 12 months what the wipe the slate clean moment is.
No, this has been... I'm working on a book called The Unclean Slate, which actually deals with this issue, but damn it, the crisis wasn't supposed to happen until after the book came out. So, unfortunately, now we have a deal testing moment. And my concern is that, you're right, it'll be interesting to see over the next year what happens as a result. Here's an organization you might not have heard of that will bear closer watching in the next year, which is called the Chiang Mai Initiative. It is a sort of local regional currency swap arrangement between China, Japan, Korea, and the ASEAN countries. If they don't get what they want within the IMF, it would not shock me if that initiative winds up taking more Asian Monetary Fund-like qualities on it.
Hmm.
I just put you to sleep, didn't I?
No. I'm having that embarrassed feeling of remembering vaguely when the initiative was announced and having said, oh, geez. So that actually sort of leads me to my last question about lasting consequences, this discussion has made clear that some of the reason, although not the only reason, that we're having these differences with Europe is a real sort of lingering feeling of anger at the U.S. for starting the crisis, which I think has joined up with the wider sense of anger on the one hand about the so-called Washington Consensus and the fiscal and monetary policies the U.S. has pursued over the last 10, 15 years, but also, you know, sort of wider anger about everything else that has happened in recent years. And so, you know, it's this odd moment where both the U.S. has a chance to sort of redeem itself, but also you sense that this anger is awfully useful to everybody else. And so do we come out of this crisis with our prestige somewhat restored, or are we just seeing that it's down? And, you know, some stuff will come back, but that we will, in fact, never be where we were.
Ooh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, I don't know if you said, there was an interesting story in the Times today about the haggling over the IMF. I mean, someone like Ken Rogoff, I think, was quoted as saying, the U.S. is acting like they were, you know, like they were 10 years ago when they were the cock of the walk. And if Ken Rogoff is saying that, that's a scary moment.
Yes.
You know, all right, I will give the full-throated defense of the United States on this one. You know, I'll play the American Nationalist card in the following sense. Here's the things to think about. First of all, as I said, the U.S. bears a large amount of blame for what's happened. But that said, it's hardly the only country that contributed to this crisis. And in fact, it's not a coincidence, by the way, that European banks are in some ways much worse off right now than the American financial institutions. So it's not clear to me that more stringent regulation is necessarily going to lead to, you know, better outcomes. So that's point one. Point two is that in these moments of crisis, one of the advantages of the U.S. system, which, you know, is presumably more market-friendly, is that it's much more flexible and adaptable. And so, you know, for example, the end of Bretton Woods 1, everyone predicted the U.S., you know, hegemony was going to be in decline. And the U.S. actually, you know, internally coped with that situation much better than people anticipated. And so it is possible that the U.S. emerges from the crisis, you know, in stronger economic shape than anyone anticipated. And part of this also is just due to things like demographics and, you know, the ability to innovate and things like that. And the third is that, you know, to be blunt politically, is there any way the U.S. could have been lower than it was, let's say, a year ago at this point? Mm-hmm. You know, this is where, oddly enough, the political system might be working in the sense of, let's face it, we voted the person, you know, we voted in someone who at least in theory was supposed to be thought of as appealing beyond American borders. Now, as it turns out that national interests clash, we'll see how long that lasts. Mm-hmm. But I do think the honeymoon's not going to end, you know, immediately. And, you know, I do have some confidence in Obama to acquit himself relatively well in articulating American interests at the global stage, better than George W. Bush did.
So I think all of that's true, and much of it may be true and not matter.
Yeah. Okay.
If you think about this Europe trip that Obama leaves on tomorrow, it's on one level it's clearly going to be a smashing success, and there are going to be adoring crowds everywhere, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be clear that we're a long way from as you say where we were a year ago. You know, yet the administration has already decided and signaled that they're not going to get any more NATO troops for Afghanistan, and they're basically going to stop asking.
Right.
And that they're basically going to stop trying to use the paradigm, the sort of all-in-together paradigm for NATO. They've already figured out that they're not going to get what they want on the global stimulus, and they're basically going to agree not to ask too loudly at the summit, and you're going to get something that's a compromise. So you're
depressing me again, but I don't disagree with any of that.
Yeah. So you know, either you take the view that the administration is screwing something up really badly here, or you take the view that the landscape has changed and it's actually not possible. You know, that sane, rational people agreed that it wasn't possible to get these things, which do seem to be pretty profoundly in the U.S. core national interest. And that says to me that the landscape has changed in some ways that probably aren't reversible. You know, it's not going to be easier to get European troops to go somewhere a year from now or 5 years from now. So you know, you see both the best and the worst at the same time, I think, in this trip.
Okay, I would push back. I mean, look at it this way. I think you're potentially correct. However, there's another thing to consider, which is basically where the world is a year from now, which is there's nothing that succeeds like success.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it turns, I mean, really, in some ways, this fundamentally rests on whether you think the Obama administration's policies will get the United States moving more quickly than, let's say, China and or Europe. If that's the case, then suddenly, you know, the U.S. has a lot more soft power at its disposal than it would have otherwise. The other thing to realize, and it should be pointed out here, is that it's not like the history of macroeconomic policy coordination is not a glorious one. There have been very few moments.
That's the understatement of the morning.
Okay, so right, I mean, you know, in other words, the fact that they're not going to agree now should be taken with a grain of salt, because the fact is, with the exception of one moment in the 80s, they really have never agreed on this sort of stuff. I mean, you can point to a whole history of cases where countries pledge to do a lot of stuff in terms of fiscal stimulus or monetary stuff, and the fact is not much of it is, it actually hasn't happened. And when it has happened, it's largely been for domestic reasons rather than the fact that, oh, we agreed to do this at the G7, therefore let's do it now. So, you know, that should be pointed out. If there is actually, you know, if it turns out that the United States winds up growing more quickly and starts, you know, increasing its economy more quickly, you know, that's going to affect, and then therefore winds up acting as a locomotive for the rest of the world, that'll actually have some effect. Although then the problem becomes that we haven't escaped the fundamental imbalance that created, that was one of the triggers for the crisis in the first place, which is the U.S. cannot be the only consumer market in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because it seems very likely to me that because the Europeans, you know, seem to be lagging. I mean, their curve is going slower, and because they grow slower than we do under the best of circumstances, it seems almost certain, although having now said that, you know, something terrible will happen and this snippet of film will be dredged up, but it seems almost certain to me that the U.S. will recover sooner and start growing faster than the Europeans do.
Well, the question is whether they will do so more than the Chinese. I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, China's growing technically, but, you know, I mean, above their 8% level and growing to the point where they're actually drawing in export, you know.
Right.
They're acting as a locomotive for the economy. I would expect the U.S. to grow, you know, more quickly. So I agree with you on that. But you never, I mean, it's, yeah, you've rendered me speechless.
Well, maybe on that note, I've rendered you speechless. We've called each other names. We've confessed our ignorance. And we've talked with some vivacity about a very technical subject for an hour. And so maybe we should declare victory.
I think we should. But I will add one last, you know, urging on this point, which is, you know, this. I think one of the problems we actually have in this country, and it's not just this country, but particularly in the United States, is that foreign policy people don't know enough about economics.
Hear, hear.
And, you know, I would like to see some of the foreign policy professionals actually sort of either admit they don't know that much about economics, but more importantly, go back and start learning. Because this stuff actually, as you said, has geopolitical consequences. And you can't just have Treasury people, you know, running the store on these sorts of things, because you want to know what the geopolitical implications are, so you need to realize that this stuff is now high diplomacy.
Well, the other problem, frankly, is that all the smartest, very smart foreign policy people get stolen over to Treasury to do the high diplomacy. So I'll add that to what you say and agree.
Okay.
Completely. And on that note.
On that note, a pleasure as always, Heather.
And you too. And look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah. Take care.